Coming up now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on the panel in Mission Control, right back on Earth, we have Richard. On this week's The Space Show, David Wilson at a joint Space Association and Mars Society event. And we're going to have an introduction to our first guest, which is David Wilson, by John Clark, who at the time was president of Mars Society Australia.
I am very, very pleased to welcome David Wilson today. David is our vice president of the Mars Society. He also runs our NASA Ames office for us. It's very good of them to host us there. David emailed me 13 years ago. He had a space nut from way back, like all of us, and you'd found out about us wanted to find out more. And before he knew what he was doing, he was running our Mars as an engineer with SEMF, a consulting firm in Hobart. He was running our Mars Oz analog station program, developing that. That led to participation in various expeditions, and before he knew it, he was at NASA Ames, where he's been working on a range of projects, including Red Dragon that we'll be hearing about today, the Icebreaker mission to concept to Mars, drilling on Mars, looking for life, and also the Enceladus mission, looking for possible life and defining the inhabitability of this small but very interesting moon of Saturn. Now, when you go to see a show, you don't want to hear the monkey, you want to listen to the organ grinder. So without any further ado, please welcome David Wilson.
And before we hear from David, I should explain that this was recorded about 7 or 8 years ago, at the time that the Cassini spacecraft had recently discovered volcanic activity on the small moon called Enceladus, a moon of Saturn. And the proposal was to send a spacecraft there and to drill down through the ice and find out what's down there, because there could well be life there. Well, here's David's outline of that proposed mission.
We in the astrobiology world have been very frustrated that people haven't gone out looking for life. There have been no life search missions since Viking. And one of my bosses said it'll be an act of Congress before we go and look for life. And sure enough, just recently, there was almost the equivalent of an act of Congress where a chairman of a House subcommittee pointed at NASA and said, "You'll go and look for life in the outer solar system." And NASA just went, "Oh, let's go and look for life." So that has prompted a change, looking for life in the ocean worlds in the outer solar system. And this slide is of the outer planets of our solar system. One is called Enceladus, which is a little moon around Saturn. And recently the Cassini space probe in the last few years has flown through these plumes. They're big geysers that are blowing out of the moon. The moon is covered in ice. Underneath there's what we now know is liquid water under the ice. The ice is kept warm, or the water is kept warm from gravitational tidal forces. And the organics collected by the Cassini, or the samples collected by the organic by the Cassini space probe, is just chock-a-block full of organics. There's a lot of organics in it. And that is just like saying life. They're not small molecules, they're big. And that's kind of a sign that there could be potentially life. So finally, quite recently, as a result of Congress pointing the finger at NASA and saying, "Go and look for life in the outer solar system now," we have collaborated with the Applied Physics Laboratory at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, and we've been working on a mission to Enceladus, which is a moon around Saturn. And around the south pole of Enceladus are these massive plumes of water which are spewing into space, probably, I think it's calculated around 200 kilograms a second going into space. And in fact, the E-ring consists of particles of that plume around Saturn. And we know now from gravitational sensor that there's probably a 20-kilometer deep ocean under there. And the gravitational forces and the tidal forces have been calculated to provide an average temperature of 100 degrees Celsius at the bottom of the ocean. So it's pretty warm down there. There's probably a lot of hypothermal vents. And Enceladus, as I said earlier, detected a lot of complex organics. We don't really know what they are. We just measured the mass of them, the molecular weight. But it was a big surprise. So the idea is given that we found methane, that there may well be methane-eating microbes in the ocean. So, by the way, this is Enceladus here compared to our moon. So he's only a little guy. He's only a little fella. So at the moment, he's quite popular. So so unlike the Mars mission, where we've been working really hard to try and get to ice, Enceladus is quite nicely spewing ice out into space for us to grab free samples, and there they all are coming out, and they've been mapped quite a lot now and surveyed by the Cassini spacecraft. So why might Enceladus be important is that it might answer some questions as to where and how life started on Earth and elsewhere. So the questions are, did life start in comets? Is it in comets and brought to Earth? Did life start on Mars and be brought to Earth via meteorites? Did life start on land on Earth? And I'll come to that in a minute. And or did it start around hypothermal vents on Earth in the oceans? And of course, Mars had hypothermal vents and oceans at one stage. It was just like Earth several billion years ago. And it had land, and of course Enceladus doesn't have land and never did. It always was an ocean world. So the question is that this might help us understand the origins of life in the solar system. And there are two kind of competing theories of life. One is that life started in hypothermal vents by this gentleman here, Mike Russell. And he, some years ago, provided, and there's a whole group of people, in fact many universities, working at demonstrating that life may have started around hypothermal vents. And there was another very fine gentleman here called Dave Deemer and his collaborator. They believe life actually started on Earth, on land, in ponds or pools that are evaporating. And just recently I talked with his collaborator, co-I, and they're about to put out a publication in Scientific American, which more or less says that they feel they've cracked it. They actually feel they've demonstrated in the lab, in the field, that at least chemistry that follows Darwinian rules can come about through pools evaporating and then refilling with water and evaporating. And there's quite a chemical process in that, and it's very interesting. It's very elegant, too. I was very very taken to their argument. If you look for life, you know, we know there's life on Earth, we think, and we believe there might have been life. Certainly there might have been life on Mars in the past, and Enceladus, which is an ocean, which we don't know, but we know there's a lot of organics being thrown out into space. In fact, Enceladus right now is the most likely place to find life. The evidence is just pointing to it at the moment. Much more than Mars, which is just very... there's no direct evidence of life on Mars at the moment from a science point of view. Life on Earth, for example, could have come from an Earth-Mars exchange where a particular form of life, somewhat life on Mars and Earth would be very similar. If life came from a comet source and then the comets handed the organics to all the planets in the solar system, then life would be very similar between Enceladus, Mars and Earth. And if life started on land, then there'd be probably no life on Enceladus. There would be life on Mars, but but it might be very different from life on Earth. I actually challenge that, because I think there's been an exchange of life all the time going on between Earth and Mars, but it's probable that there would have been different. And then if life started in a sea vent, we could find life or evidence of life in all three places, and they might be all different, very different. So going for look for life will help us to understand the origin of life on Earth and in our solar system, and of course elsewhere in the universe. And the kind of things we're looking for is amino acids. So life on Earth uses 20 amino acids, and 10 are found floating around in space, and the remaining 10 are made. That biology has made it, or something's made it. And I understand that there could be up to 500 combinations of amino acids that you could have. So for some reason, life's chosen a particular set of 20. And it could be that life elsewhere uses amino acids as well, but they've chosen a slightly different set of 20, and so on. And that's one way of sensing life. If you've got a pile of organics and you've got a strong signal of 20 or so amino acids, then you think, well, that's quite unusual, very unusual. The other thing is creality, which life on Earth, its amino acids are left-handed. So you can, in space, it's random. It can be either right-handed or left-handed. But the molecules on Earth for life are all left-handed. So why are a lot of us are right-handed. I don't know whether that means anything, but... So life elsewhere could be all right-handed, or it could be all left-handed, or it could be a mixture. But if we found in a sample amino acids, all of which were one-handed or very dominated by that, then we would say, well, this is definitely a presence of life or an indicator of life. The other thing of life, generally life has very large organic molecules, and large organic molecules have been found coming out of Enceladus. And also, life prefers low-mass carbon isotopes. So those are the kind of things, between all of those, all together, that kind of suggests that there's life. And the only other way of knowing for sure is if you find something wriggling around in a microscope that's moving and laughing at you. And it's very difficult to convince scientists that there is life, of what life is and what it isn't, especially at this level, the level of molecules. So it's actually quite a tricky job. We unfortunately have no tricorder. We need one desperately, by the way, if you can make one. So my role in Enceladus is to do the capture. We plan to capture the ice in the plume. We plan to fly through the plume at about the speed of a jet plane and sweep in all the ice particles into one spot. And I've been using the fastest gun in the West, which is a big gun. It is in fact a gun. It uses, I think, old World War II cannons, but it uses a 0.5 caliber shell that fires pellets, or a pellet, and can fire pellets, well, very lightweight ones, up to 7 kilometers per second. So it really is the fastest gun in the West. So we fire a pellet at an ice pie, which is at minus 180 degrees. We've dipped it in liquid nitrogen outside, and then we put it inside the gun chamber, pump all the air out and fire the gun. And you get a plume, and the front end of the plume, these little particles are coming out at about the right speed and about the right size. And then we've been filming those going into our collector. So this is kind of how we've been designing our collector. There is apparently, I met an Australian the day that I left to come to Australia. An Australian came in and he's working in a similar gun in Seattle. And he told me it's not as fast as ours, but it's got more Viagra. So what can you say?
That was the late David Wilson, who at the time was a research and development engineer of Space Science and Astrobiology Division at the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. He was asked by members of the audience a couple of questions, and one of them was about a submarine. Could you have a submarine on Titan or Europa?
Angelo from the Space Association. Just a question. Have you heard any more about the Enceladus mission with a little submarine?
I think the one with the submarine is Titan. Yeah, I think that's... So the question was, have you heard of a mission with a submarine to Enceladus? And the answer is there is a one being looked at with a submarine, and I think that's for Titan more. So the other ice world that people are very interested in is Europa, which is around Jupiter, which is nearer, by the way. And the problem with Jupiter is that there are no plumes or big plumes coming out. It's believed there are some small ones, and some people say they've seen them, but they're not so obvious as Enceladus. So there is a risk that you go to Europa and it's just all hard ice all the way around. I've got to be careful what I say there, because the guys planning missions to Europa may disagree with that, but certainly Europa, Enceladus is just so obvious, let's put it that way. It's just screaming at you. But it is much further away. It's much harder to get to.
And since David was talking, there is now a mission on the way to Europa to pass by Europa and look for those plumes if they exist. And there's more evidence now that they do. And that mission is called Europa Express. We have covered that on the Space Show recently. And David Wilson was also asked about the hope for life.
When you're having a cup of coffee with your colleagues and you start talking about life elsewhere in the solar system, what's the general feeling? Is there, you know, do they think there is life or could probably be life on Mars, Europa, Enceladus?
Yeah, it depends who you talk to, but I think there's a very high hope that there's life on Enceladus. And that's because of the large numbers of organics coming out in the plume. And I think that since the idea of an exchange of material between Earth and Mars, and the fact that we are very, very confident that there in the past has been a big ocean on Mars, a lot of people are quite positive that there certainly may have been life in the past. And I was talking to a biologist who feels quite confident there's life there, as I do now, but probably underground. Yeah, so the fact that the icebreaker was looking for extant life means it's recent, it's not a fossil, it's actually frozen in the ground, dormant, waiting. That's an indication there was a whole group of people backed by the Ames administration to go and look for extant life. Well, that kind of answers your question. Yeah, everyone thinks there might be life on Mars, but and it's worth $500 million to go and look for it. I guess that answers that question. I haven't really thought about that in great detail.
At the time, they thought it was worthwhile. Well, a certain president of the United States doesn't think it's worthwhile. David was speaking to a meeting of the Space Association and the Mars Society, a joint meeting, and at the time, SpaceX had just recently got a contract to supply materials to the International Space Station, and he spoke to that topic.
So just as so NASA in the, I forget, some 10 years ago, started the COTS program, which is commercial off the shelf, but it was a program to give money to industry to develop technology, off-the-shelf technology, to go to space. They selected, and over a number of years, they selected companies and gave them lots of money to develop new spacecraft and new ways of going to space with the aim to make it cheaper and to take the shift the burden of transport to the private sector rather than the government sector. So, for example, at the moment, the US supplies the space station with the SpaceX Dragon and the Orbiter Sciences Cygnus spacecraft, and both have been fulfilling their contracts, and both have had rockets blowing up, by the way. They have just signed a new contract now with three companies. One is, again, SpaceX with their Dragon. Another is Orbital ATK with their Cygnus again. And then another one is Sierra Nevada, which is a space plane. And these guys will be providing supplies to the space station up until 2024, according to the contract that they've just signed up. So I'll go through this very quickly, give you an idea of what's happening. There are a lot of changes happening over the next few years, and it's accelerating. Then we have the commercial crew development, and NASA have signed up two companies to develop spacecraft to fly people to the space station. And one, of course, is Dragon spacecraft, and another is the Boeing CST-100, the Starliner. And what's unique about the Dragon is they plan to land their space capsule on rockets on land, and that's a very important feature for what we'll talk about in just a minute. But first of all, they plan to fly astronauts in 2017, sometime during that year, and the astronauts will be landing in the ocean, I believe. They still need to develop the landing capacity or bring it up to human-rated, I guess. In the meantime, Boeing has been developing their capsule, which lands on land on airbags, and that's a slightly different concept, but both have been given contracts to supply the space station. Also, in addition to that, we've got other players like the Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. And these are guys I think you need to watch because they haven't been given huge sums of money, and they're developing technology that and I guess systems that may in fact in the future be very competitive. So Virgin Galactic with their aircraft will be, both of these companies are doing suborbital flights, and Virgin Galactic will be, I think they'll be flying their space plane quite soon. That's just a rumour that I've heard. At the same time, Blue Origin have flown and landed and flown and landed their rocket three times. So they have, in fact, recovered their rocket and flown it three times, which is quite a remarkable achievement. Even though it's not the same as going into orbit, it is still a remarkable achievement. And these guys may well... I would watch these guys. Meanwhile, NASA's been developing the Orion spacecraft, which is a very big, deep space craft for carrying people into the outer into the solar system or beyond Earth orbit. And what's inside it is vastly more complex than, say, what's in Dragon and Boeing CST-100, where at the moment they're only going to low Earth orbit. The NASA managers say in one of their recent talks that they have been, the technology that they've been reviewing or developing for the Orion, it gets forwarded on to the other companies also developing their space capsules. So it's not as if they're doing this independently. Everything they learn and develop is being forwarded through to the private sector. So it is a very much a cooperation. At the same time, we have new rockets being built, NASA Space Launch System, which is very big. Orbital Sciences Antares blew up over a year ago, but I believe they're going to be flying again. Falcon 9 is flying. It blew up too, and they've fixed that, and they're flying. And of course, in the media, you hear a lot of SpaceX doing its landings, and they've landed, I think, three times now. They haven't reflown their rockets yet, but so just from that point of view, they're saying when they get flying and recovering their rockets, there'll be a 30%. Reduction in orbital costs going into low orbit, at least for the moment. So from the paradigm point of view, the payload can make up five times the price or the cost of the overall rocket going into orbit. So 30% in cost of recovering a rocket may not provide a significant reduction in cost when it comes to the cost of the payload, which is up to four or five times the rocket itself currently. However, it may open a new market which enables low-cost payloads to go into orbit cheaper. So I think it's a great thing, and it may in fact open a gate to a new market.
So that was David Wilson speaking to the Space Association several years ago. Now, as I said, several years ago, so let's update some of the things that have happened since he was talking. Dragon, yes, Crew Dragon has been developed, and it does land in the water. They still haven't done the landing on land, so it's splashdown rather than landing. Boeing, yes, the Starliner does land on the land, and they had one human flight with it and a few test flights, but it's in strife and it's not in regular operation, unlike the Crew Dragon, which they can even rent out to private citizens to fly. And then they talked about the suborbital missions. The Virgin Galactic, yeah, they made several flights with passengers, but it's not in regular service at the moment. But with Blue Origin, that's going great guns with their new Shepherd, and they've even flown two Australians on it up above the Kármán line, over 100 kilometres. Orion, yes, and the SLS, that's had serious problems. They flew one mission around the moon unmanned, and were due to fly this year a human crew of four around the moon, not landing on the moon, but around the moon. And that's been put back until next year. And mention of the Falcon rocket, that in fact has been the most successful. It's now the most successful rocket in the world, and it has effected a massive cost reduction in getting stuff into space, and it's actually put several of the traditional providers out of business in a way. So that was David Wilson. You're listening to The Space Show.